Lecture 2, Key Traits, Extroversion and Neuroticism.
The English language contains more than 3,000 words that refer to personality characteristics of various kinds. Words like outgoing and anxious and irresponsible and humble and greedy. I think that's kind of interesting in its own right, because it shows how important it is in everyday life to have words that describe what people are like. We all spend a lot of time thinking about and talking about our own and other people's personality characteristics. And all of those words come in pretty handy. But having all of these words creates a problem for studying and understanding personality. Clearly, there aren't really 3,000 different personality characteristics. Many of these words in any language are synonyms or near synonyms for the same traits. So if someone is nervous a great deal of the time, we can say that they're a nervous person, or we can say that they're anxious, or they're tense, or that they're neurotic. These words might have slightly different shades of meaning, but they all refer to basically the same characteristic. With so many different words that refer to personality characteristics, researchers have faced a serious challenge in trying to figure out how many basic personality traits there really are. This has been a surprisingly difficult task, and it's made even more challenging by the fact that not all personality traits are created equal. Some characteristics are more important than others in understanding people's behavior and in predicting important outcomes in people's lives, such as the nature of their relationships with other people, the degree to which they're successful at achieving their goals, their psychological well-being, and their health. For example, it usually tells you more about what a person is like to know whether they're dependable or honest than it is to know whether they are tidy or excitable. Dependability and honesty are simply more important, more informative characteristics than tidiness and excitability are. They account for more variability in people's behavior, and they have more important implications for people's lives. If we want to understand a person's behavior and the choices they make and how they get along with other people, knowing about how dependable and honest they are is far more useful than knowing whether they are tidy or excitable. To understand people's personalities, it makes sense to start with the most important characteristics, the ones that best help us to understand their behavior and that relate most strongly to important outcomes in their lives. So in this and the next lecture, we're going to focus on the most important traits before turning to other characteristics as we move through the course. But how can we figure out how many different personality traits there are? And how do we know which ones are most important in understanding people's thoughts, motives, emotions, and behavior? When psychological researchers started to tackle the question of basic personality traits in the 1930s and 40s, they turned to what was then a newly developed statistical procedure called factor analysis. Factor analysis is a statistical technique that can be used to identify the basic dimensions that underlie a set of variables that are correlated or related to each other. I'm not going to explain how factor analysis works mathematically, but I do want you to understand what it does, because it's important for understanding basic personality traits. Imagine that we asked a large number of people to rate themselves on, say, 100 characteristics that describe various aspects of personality. So they rate themselves on words such as enthusiastic, critical, dependable, anxious, reserved, sympathetic, careless, calm, outgoing, assertive, creative, maybe even excitable. We could have people rate themselves on all 100 of these characteristics on a 5-point scale that ranges from not at all to extremely. Now, Imagine that we correlated people's ratings on each pair of these 100 characteristics. A correlation is a statistic that tells us how strongly two variables are related to each other. For example, across all of our respondents, we could calculate the correlation between people's ratings of how enthusiastic they are and how assertive they are. And this number, this correlation, would tell us how strongly people's ratings of enthusiasm are related to their ratings of assertiveness. And we could calculate a correlation between every pair of those 100 ratings. That's 4,950 different correlations that give us a picture of how strongly each of these 100 characteristics is related to each of the other characteristics. If we look at all of these 4,950 correlations among people's ratings of the 100 characteristics, we'll find that some of the characteristics correlate highly with each other, while other characteristics don't. For example, how people rate themselves on the characteristic dependable probably correlates pretty highly with how they rate themselves on the characteristic organized. People who are dependable also tend to be organized, and people who are undependable also tend to be disorganized. So these two ratings of dependable and organized will probably correlate highly with each other. When you find that ratings on one characteristic are highly correlated with ratings on another characteristic, a reasonable conclusion is that these two ratings are tapping into the same basic trait. If people who rate themselves highly on X consistently rate themselves highly on Y, then perhaps X and Y aren't really two different things at all, but rather two ratings of the same general characteristic. So, in the case of ratings of dependable and organized, these two characteristics might be aspects of the same general trait. On the other hand, when you find that ratings on one characteristic are not highly correlated with ratings on another characteristic, then those two characteristics must be different things. So, for example, people's ratings of how dependable they are might not be correlated with their ratings of, say, how sociable they are. And this would tell us that dependability and sociability are separate traits. Now, if we were actually looking at a table of 4,950 correlations among people's ratings on 100 characteristics, we wouldn't be able to make much sense of things. But that's where factor analysis comes in. Factor analysis takes information about how all of these ratings correlate with each other and mathematically determines how many basic traits are actually being measured. So factor analysis has been an indispensable tool for identifying basic personality traits from the hundreds of words that we use to describe personality. By the 1980s, a high degree of consensus had emerged that human personality is characterized by only 5 basic personality traits. These 5 traits became known as the Big 5, and they've been the focus of an incredible amount of research. As we'll see later, many other traits exist, but these 5 have become recognized as the most important traits for understanding people's personalities and behavior. But before we talk about these 5 traits, I want to be clear about exactly what a personality trait is. As psychologists use the term, a personality trait is an internal psychological characteristic that involves the tendency to respond in a particular way. Think about your own behavior. Do you tend to be outgoing or more reserved in social situations? Well, you probably aren't either one all the time. Sometimes you're more outgoing, and sometimes you're more reserved. But if we followed you around and watched you in many different situations, we'd probably find that you show a tendency to lean one way or the other. You might tend to be more outgoing, or you might tend to be more reserved. The fact that you show a particular tendency and how you respond across situations suggests that you possess some psychological characteristic or perhaps a set of characteristics, that predisposes you to react one way or the other. So we would say that you have a trait that predisposes you to tend to be outgoing or reserved or whatever. So by definition, the concept of a trait implies that a person will show a certain degree of consistency in his or her thoughts, feelings, or behaviors across different situations. If you have a particular trait, we ought to be able to see a tendency for you to respond in a particular way across different situations. Of course, even when people have a trait, they don't act the same way all the time. Different situations call for different kinds of behaviors. And people who act exactly the same way all the time don't adapt to the demands of specific situations. No matter how outgoing you are, you must sometimes be reserved. And no matter how reserved you usually are, situations sometimes require you to be sociable. So nothing in the concept of a trait implies that a person acts the same way all the time. In fact, that would be a sign of a personality disorder, which we'll talk about later. Again, having a trait simply means that people show a tendency to respond in a particular way. The concept of a trait also implies a certain degree of consistency over time in how people tend to respond. As we'll discuss in a later lecture, people's personality traits can and do change over time, at least within limits. But over the short run, we see stability in their traits. If you tend to be outgoing this month, we aren't likely to find that you have become consistently reserved a few months from now. It can happen, for example, if people experience a traumatic event. But under normal circumstances, personality shows a good deal of stability over time. It helps to think of any given trait as a dimension or continuum that ranges from low to high. And people are spread out along that continuum, from those who are very low on the trait to those who are very high on the trait. Consider the trait of sensation seeking. Sensation seeking involves people's tendency to enjoy and to seek out experiences that are intense and exciting. How do you feel about activities such as roller coaster rides, skydiving, and even just driving fast? If you're at the low end of the sensation-seeking trait continuum, you dislike these kinds of experiences, and you do whatever you can to avoid them. And it's not necessarily because you're afraid. You simply find high levels of stimulation unpleasant. Or you may be thinking, well, now and then I enjoy stimulating experiences like roller coasters, but in general, I'm not really interested. So you might be moderate in sensation seeking, somewhere in the middle of the continuum. But it could be that you're excited by just the mention of these kinds of stimulating experiences. If you're high in sensation seeking, you may seek out regular opportunities to enjoy excitement. And you may even start to feel restless or bored if you don't have enough excitement and stimulation in your life. So we have a continuum of sensation seeking that runs from people who are very low in sensation seeking to those who are moderate to those who are very high. And we can put every person somewhere along that trait dimension. Furthermore, people's scores on most traits are normally distributed. That is, if we look at people's scores, we find that they show that classic bell-shaped or normal distribution, in which most people score toward the middle, with fewer and fewer people having more extreme scores as we move away from the middle. Sensation-seeking is normally distributed. Most people have a middle-of-the-road approach to exciting experiences. They like them sometimes, but don't seek them out on a regular basis. At the low end are people who truly detest such experiences, the kind who try never to do them. And at the upper end of the scale are high sensation seekers, who love these kinds of experiences and seek them out at every opportunity. And the distribution is bell-shaped. Most people fall in the middle range, with fewer and fewer people as we move toward either extreme. As we talk about different traits in this course, I always want you to think about where you might fall along whatever trait dimension we are discussing. Are you low, medium, or high on the trait? Let me make one other point about traits. In everyday language, we sometimes talk about personality types. People ask us, what type of person are you? So I want to explain the difference between a personality trait and a personality type. As I just explained, a trait can be visualized as a dimension or a continuum, and people can fall anywhere along the trait dimension from very low to very high. And when psychologists measure any particular trait, people's scores can range from very low to very high. In the case of sensation seeking, for example, scores on one measure of sensation seeking can range anywhere from 0 to 40. In contrast, when we talk about a personality type, we are categorizing people into a small number of discrete categories or groups, sometimes only two. So instead of giving you a score on a continuous measure of sensation seeking, we could simply classify you as being low or high in sensation seeking. Or we could classify you as a dominant or submissive person, or as depressed or not depressed, or as an extrovert versus an introvert. In each case, we have classified you as a type of person, a low sensation seeker, a dominant person, an introvert, or whatever, by putting you in a category. Personality researchers almost never talk about personality types, because true personality types almost never exist. That is, there are not many psychological characteristics in which people naturally and cleanly fall into one category or another. Instead, people vary from one another across all levels of a trait continuum. You and I might both be low in sensation seeking, but maybe you're much lower than I am. And researchers want to measure and explain that difference. Putting both of us in the low sensation seeker box throws away a great deal of information and nuance that's important in understanding people's behavior. Many people have taken the Myers-Briggs type indicator at some point in their life. The Myers-Briggs is used a great deal to help people understand their own personality, particularly in work organizations, to help employees understand how they differ from their coworkers. It helps people to recognize differences in how people approach situations and problems. And thus it helps people work together more effectively. But the Myers-Briggs type indicator is, as its name indicates, a type indicator. It basically tells you what type of person you are on four characteristics: extrovert versus introvert, sensing versus intuition, thinking versus feeling, and judging versus perceiving. You don't need to understand what those terms mean. But after people take the Myers-Briggs, they get a four-letter code that tells them which of 16 types they are. If you have taken the Myers-Briggs, you can probably remember your type. You're an ISTJ or an INFP or an ESTP or whatever. And that code reflects your type. Well, as a way to provide people with insights about their own and other people's personalities, the Myers-Briggs is quite useful. It not only gives people insight into their own personality, but it also helps people understand others. So once I realized that a coworker and I have different approaches to the world, that we're different types, I can work within those differences rather than just assume that the coworker is being obstinate or doesn't like me or is mentally unbalanced. And part of the Myers-Briggs usefulness in the workplace lies in its type-based approach. For practical purposes, it's easier for people to think in terms of types of personalities rather than in terms of traits on a continuum. However, for scientific understanding, not only do types badly misrepresent the nature of personality, But the characteristics measured by the Myers-Briggs don't easily map onto the basic personality traits that have been uncovered by personality research. So, although it's a practical tool, personality researchers rarely use the Myers-Briggs type indicator. Now that you have a sense of what a personality trait is, we're going to take a look at the five basic traits that researchers have uncovered. Let me stress up front that there's much more to personality than these five traits. Dozens of important traits have been identified involving differences in the motives that drive people's behavior, their tendencies to experience specific emotions, their beliefs about the world and themselves, their styles of thinking, and other psychological processes. We'll be looking at many of these traits throughout the course. But to begin, let's look at the most basic traits, the so-called Big Five. I'm going to introduce the first two Big Five traits in this lecture, and then we'll pick up the other three in the next lecture. From the beginning of the scientific study of personality, everyone has agreed that the most important trait is the trait of extroversion. Now, what I mean by most important is that the trait of extroversion underlies more of people's behavior and more of the differences that we see among people than any other single trait. What a psychological scientist might say is that extroversion accounts for more variability in human behavior than any other trait. We can understand more about why people do what they do if we know how extroverted they are than by knowing about any other characteristic. When we talk about the trait of extroversion, we're talking about a dimension that runs from being very low in extroversion at one end to being very high in extroversion at the other. Now, in everyday language, we often use the label introvert to describe people who are low in extroversion. But personality researchers generally talk about low versus high extroversion rather than about introverts and extroverts. Partly, that's to avoid thinking of extroversion and introversion as if they're personality types. As I mentioned, most personality characteristics are continuous traits rather than categorical types, and that's true of extroversion. In addition, we usually don't contrast introverts with extroverts in order to avoid the suggestion that introversion is somehow the opposite of extroversion, which it isn't. Introverts simply fall in the lower tail of the normal distribution of extroversion scores. So, for example, introverts may like social interactions less than extroverts do, but they don't necessarily dislike interacting with other people at all. And introverts may be less assertive than extroverts are, but they aren't necessarily non-assertive or submissive. So to avoid suggesting that introverts and extroverts are somehow opposites, we usually talk about people who are low versus high in extroversion. I'll probably lapse into referring to extroverts and introverts from time to time. But keep in mind that we're really talking about a dimension of low to high extroversion. Extroversion has a number of interrelated features, but its central characteristic is sociability. The higher that people score in extroversion, the more they enjoy interacting with other people. Compared to people who are low in extroversion, people who are high in extroversion are more gregarious. They enjoy social gatherings more, including large parties, and they seek out opportunities to interact with other people more often. And, as you would expect, when they're in social situations, people who are higher in extroversion are more talkative than people low in extroversion are. People high in extroversion are so highly motivated to interact with other people that when they're alone for a long time, they sometimes go on a search just for somebody to talk to. Many studies of extroversion have been conducted in controlled laboratory settings in which people are observed interacting with others. However, some of the best evidence for the behaviors that are associated with low and high extroversion has examined people's behavior during everyday life. In one study, participants completed a measure of extroversion, and then they wore an electronically activated recorder as they went about their daily lives. This recorder was programmed to turn on for a few minutes randomly throughout the day, providing objective data about what the participants were doing at the time. Analyses of the recorded data showed that participants who scored higher in extroversion were much more likely to be interacting with other people at times when the recorder activated than participants who were lower in extroversion. Although sociability is the key feature of extroversion, people who are low versus high in extroversion differ in other ways as well. For example, people who are high in extroversion tend to be more assertive and dominant than people lower in extroversion. They are also more energetic and active, and they like to stay busier than people who are lower in extroversion do. High extroverts also tend to be somewhat more upbeat and cheerful than people low in extroversion. But researchers don't completely understand why extroverts tend to experience more positive emotions. One possibility is that physiologically, high extroverts are more sensitive to rewards than people who are lower in extroversion. We'll come back to this idea in a later lecture, but it seems that extroverts are more oriented toward having rewarding experiences, and they have a lower threshold for experiencing pleasure. Because they're more focused on rewards, people high in extroversion may tend to behave in ways that promote their own happiness more than low extroverts do. Another possible explanation is that given how much of life requires interacting with other people, those who really enjoy interacting with others will be happier in the course of everyday life than people who don't enjoy interacting as much. That's extroversion. The second most important trait, number two of the big five, is usually called neuroticism. But because the word neuroticism has such negative connotations, many researchers now call it emotional stability. But whatever we call it, the central feature of neuroticism, or emotional stability, is the degree to which people experience negative emotions. People who are higher in neuroticism tend to experience negative emotions more frequently than people who are low in neuroticism. And their negative emotions tend to be more intense, and they last longer. Some people simply experience unpleasant emotions, such as anxiety, sadness, anger, guilt, and regret, more than other people do. In fact, some researchers call this trait negative emotionality, which describes it pretty well. Although the defining feature of neuroticism involves negative emotionality, people who are high in neuroticism also display a general sense of insecurity and vulnerability. People who are high in neuroticism are more afraid of things that don't bother other people very much, and they tend to worry more about bad things that might happen in the future. As they walk through life, they focus on the possible risks ahead, risks involving their physical safety, possible failures, public embarrassments, rejections, and so on. So they try to avoid situations that look risky or threatening. People who are high in neuroticism also tend to overreact to ordinary sorts of hassles and frustrations. They get bent out of shape more easily than people low in neuroticism. They're also less satisfied with their lives, which isn't surprising. If you tend to experience negative emotions frequently, everything seems less satisfying. At the other end of the continuum, people who are very low in neuroticism walk through life with a certain amount of equanimity, and they tend to be more satisfied with life. Not surprisingly, then, people who score higher in neuroticism need more emotional support from other people. So they often tend to be somewhat needy and dependent, High neuroticism is not only distressing for people, but it's also associated with a number of negative outcomes. For example, neuroticism predicts more conflict and lower satisfaction in people's marriages and other close relationships. The more people experience negative emotions, the more volatile their relationships tend to be. And the romantic partners of people who are high in neuroticism are less satisfied with their relationships as well. It's harder to live with a partner who's high in negative emotionality. People high in neuroticism also experience a greater number of health problems. They actually have a higher mortality rate, and they're particularly likely to get heart disease. Not only does a high level of stress create certain medical problems directly, but negative emotions can compromise the immune system in a way that makes it harder for the body to deal with whatever problem the person has. This connection is so strong that some psychologists have called neuroticism a major public health problem. But why do some people experience more negative emotions than other people do? We'll talk about the genetic basis of personality in a later lecture. So for now, I'll just mention that neuroticism has a strong genetic component. Some people are born with brains that respond more strongly to negative events, so they react more easily to threats of various kinds. But children can also learn to be neurotic to some extent. When parents are anxious or angry or upset a lot, their children learn to view high emotionality as normal, and they don't observe their parents using effective coping strategies that we all need to get by. On top of that, parents who openly express their own fears and concerns and who are overprotective can lead their children to perceive the world as a dangerous and unhappy place. And worse, parents who are neglectful, rejecting, or abusive can cause their children to be chronically fearful and vulnerable. As I mentioned, extroversion and neuroticism are the most important, most informative traits in the human personality. If you could have only two pieces of information about someone that would give you the broadest picture of what they're like, you'd probably want to find out about how extroverted and how neurotic they are. But there's a lot more to personality than extroversion and neuroticism, and we'll move on to the three other Big Five traits in the next lecture.